give this cloakroom talk. This is actually a bit technical subject, but I'll try to make it as accessible to the diverse audience as possible. But I do realize that there's only a finite amount of things I can talk about within 1 hour. But so in any case, feel free to stop me at any point if you want me to elaborate on any of the details, which a lot of I'm going to have to skip due to lack of time. The outline of the talk is going to be the following. I will spend a little time making some remarks on quantum gravity and holography. Then I'll explain higher spin gauge theories, what they are, and what can we calculate using these, and their role in holography, namely the holographic duality between higher spin gauge theories in anti-de-Sitter space and conformal vector models, which I'll explain. And finally, I'll come back to string theory and discuss a little bit of the relation between this higher spin gauge theory and string theories. So I would like to begin with a question: what is quantum gravity? And I'll try to answer this question in a way as concrete as possible. Like any theory of quantum gravity, like any quantum theory, if you have a quantum theory, you first want to ask, what is the Hilbert space? And given the Hilbert space, what are the observables? And what can you calculate? For instance, in the quantum field theory, the Hilbert space is the space can be described in terms of either the in-state or out-state of asymptotic states of particles that scatter. The observables are the S-matrix elements, and you can calculate these using perturbation theory or sometimes beyond perturbation theory. In quantum gravity, well, you might think this question is, well, you might worry whether it's really well defined. In the quantum gravity, in theory of quantum gravity, I would say that a priori, the theory is only defined provided some particular asymptotic boundary condition. Because even though in the theory of gravity, you can change the geometry of spacetime, but any finite energy excitation should only be able to modify the geometry of spacetime locally. It should keep the asymptotic boundary condition fixed. So for instance, we can start with flat spacetime, we can start with anti-de-Sitter space or some other spacetime, and when consider the scattering particles in this background, in the scattering process, the metric will fluctuate and change the spacetime geometry may change, but it should it should be possible to describe a scattering process in with some fixed asymptotic boundary condition. I would regard the asymptotic boundary condition as part of a definition of quantum theory of gravity. And as far as I can see, there's a priori no reason why there should be a background independent formulation of quantum gravity for this reason. Now, I'll discuss two. Yes?
I really don't understand that. I mean, are you saying we couldn't do cosmology of a closed, spatially closed universe, for example?
Well, I would try to define that theory first. And for me, I don't know how to define such a theory. What I do know how to define is, in principle, quantum theory of gravity in flat asymptotic flat spacetime, where the Hilbert space are those of scattering states. And I can speak of the S matrix. Or I can talk about quantum gravity in anti-de-Sitter space, where there is a Hilbert space of normalizable states because the space behave like a box. If you want to do quantum gravity in complex spacetime, I don't know how to do that because I don't know what the Hilbert space is. It's rather a statement of my ignorance rather than the statement about what are the possibilities.
It's not a statement about the real world, is it?
If you want to define a theory of quantum gravity, you have to, if it's a quantum theory, I would like to ask what the Hilbert space is. And if you cannot tell me what the Hilbert space is, to me, that's not a well-defined theory. That's not a well-defined quantum theory.
How do you know the board doesn't have a boundary?
I don't. So that as far as we can see.
So it could be a statement about the board.
If we want to deal with the world that we can see, then we better not assume a boundary.
Well, I would prefer to talk about things that I do know how to define rather than things that I do not know how to define. So I'll stay with the theories that I think I know how to define. As I already mentioned, the two basic examples are flat spacetime and anti-de-Sitter spacetime. I like these two examples because I think I know how to define the Hilbert space, and I think I know what the interesting observables are. In the case of flat spacetime, the observables are going to be S-matrix of elementary particles such as gravitons or other particles. In end-of-the-series space-time, the interesting observables are going to be boundary correlation functions. In other words, the end-of-the-series space, which I'll discuss in slightly more detail in a moment, you can consider some boundary source, which will create some, say, incoming flux of particles, and they can interact in and then escape to infinity. You can measure the response near at the boundary of the space at some later time. But the important question is, what can you actually calculate? In flat space time, we know that string perturbation theory is a UV-complete quantum theory of gravity in perturbation at the level of perturbation theory. It's a framework for computing perturbative S-matrix elements. This framework, however, necessarily breaks down at Planckian at Planck scale. If you try to compute the scattering of, say, two gravitons into three gravitons at Planckian energy, then, say, in the framework of string perturbation theory, then all loop contributions in string perturbation theory will come in the same order, and loop expansion necessarily breaks down. We do not have a priori in string theory a non-perturbative framework for computing S-matrix elements of just graviton scattering at all energy scale. Now, but on the other hand, we do know something about what should happen to a scattering, say between two gravitons at extremely high energy. If you have scattering of two gravitons at extremely high energy, you have energy high enough to make a Schwarzschild black hole of macroscopic radius. In that case, you expect a black hole to be created and then decay slowly through Hawking radiation. The odds of finding, only three gravitons in the final state of Hawking radiation after black hole decay away is, of course, very small. It's going to be suppressed by e to the minus the entropy of the black hole. Nonetheless, that would serve as the estimate for the scattering cross-section of two to three graviton scattering at extremely high energy. Now, that description by Hawking radiation is manifestly non-unitary. And we do not have a framework that allows us to describe such scattering. So far, I have not described any framework that allows us to describe such scattering at all energy scale that allows you to extrapolate from low energy, where you can apply perturbation theory, to high energy, where you have the semi-classical picture of Hawking radiation. And that's, to me, one of the biggest problem or question in quantum gravity that I'd like to answer, I'd like to address. I won't tell you the answer to that. I won't be able to tell you the answer to that. In ADS space-time, on the other hand, via holography, which I'll discuss in a moment, all the interesting observables, in principle, should be computable from the dual conformal field theory, which in some sense live on the boundary of the space. I'll now discuss three primary examples of holography. The first example is the so-called BFSS matrix quantum mechanics, named after the original conjecture by Banks, Fischler, Schenker, and Susskind. This duality can be regarded as a holographic duality. It's between 11-dimensional N theory in a particular space-time geometry. When I say M theory on this space-time, I mean the asymptotic boundary condition that defines my theory is going to be given by this metric. Now, of course, on top of that, I will consider fluctuations, but these fluctuations are going to be, I'm going to restrict myself to finite energy fluctuations that only modify the geometry locally. So in that sense, there should be a well-defined set of asymptotic states or scattering states. The geometry is as follows. It's asymptotically null. If you want to see what explicitly the metric is, it's written up here. But suffice to point out that it's asymptotically a null compactification. But anywhere at finite distance, it's not a null compactification. The dual theory, I'll explain in what sense it is dual, is a quantum mechanics. The statement is that this M theory, 11-dimensional M theory, in this particular geometry is equivalent to the 16 supercharged SUN gauged quantum mechanics described by this Hamiltonian. Here, Xi's are n by n Hermitian matrices, thetas, where I runs from 1 to 9. Theta are a set of 16 fermionic n by n matrices, which obey Clifford algebra upon canonical quantization. And the PIs are the are the n by m matrices, which are the canonical momentum conjugate to the xi. And then further, you restrict yourself to the SUN invariant wave functions. That's all. It's a very, well, the gamma i's are 16, well, these are 16 by 16 SO9 gamma matrices. Looks like a very innocent theory. So what the geometry looks like is the following. So the M theory, which lives in 11 dimensions, upon a circle commutation, reduces to type 2A string theory in 10 dimensions. The geometry I just wrote down in the last slide look like this in type 2A string theory. If you reduce on the circle, the circle was parameterized by this y coordinate, which is periodically identified, but note that the proper length of the circle is controlled by this function f of r, which depends on the radius. So reduced to type 2A string theory, you have time and nine-dimensional space. The M theory circle shrinks to zero size as you move toward infinity and blows up as you move toward the center of this nine-dimensional space. Now, if you actually examine carefully what type 2A string geometry looks like, it looks like the following. At very large distance in the spatial direction, you have a very stringy type 2A geometry in the sense that the curvature is at string scale or bigger. So this looks very different from ordinary gravity. Now, at some large but not too large radius, the geometry of the spacetime is such that the low energy dynamics is described by type 2A supergravity. So these are just ordinary Einstein gravity plus some additional massless fields that completes the supermultiplet. Then as you move further toward the origin of the spacetime, you will discover that the appropriate description is not type 2A supergravity, but rather 11-dimensional supergravity. And then there's this red part here, which is very close to the origin of spacetime, where the curvature is Planckian. That's where we really don't know what's going on. And this is supposed to be equivalent somehow to this SU-engaged matrix quantum mechanics. In what sense is that true? I'll just illustrate this with one example. If you consider the scattering of the so-called D0 brains, which are particles in the mass spectrum of in the spectrum of type 2A string theory. These are non-perturbative objects. They can scatter. It turns out that in this particular very funny looking type 2A string theory background, the only particles that are allowed to move out to infinity are D0 brains, nothing else. So the D0 brains and also their bound states are the only allowed asymptotic states of my theory. So I claim the scattering states of D0 brains, or BPS supersymmetric bound states of D0 brains, are comprise the entire Hilbert space of this theory. That's partly a conjecture, but I'm pretty sure it's a correct conjecture. Now these D0 brains that come in from infinity, described by some wave packets in quantum mechanics, coming from infinity can scatter. If they do some scattering, they can either end up here at the singularity or they can escape to infinity. Well, if they end up here at the singularity, they can probably form a small black hole and the black hole will eventually Hawking radiate away. But anyway, we expect that the end result of such a scattering is that some D0 brains come in, some D0 brains escape back to infinity and described by some S matrix. The claim of the duality is that this S matrix should be the same as the S matrix that describes the scattering of wave packets of eigenvalues of those matrices xi in the matrix quantum mechanics, roughly speaking. And that's supposed to be an exact statement. So if you can compute, if you're powerful enough to compute the exact S matrix in this quantum mechanics, whose asymptotic states are wave packets of the eigenvalues, you'll be able to produce the exact S matrix of D0 brain scattering in type 2A string theory, which is related to scattering of gravitons in M theory. Yes. Well, I do not know what's going on if a D0 brain moves to the center. What I do know is that if there's enough energy, you'll make a black hole, if there's enough energy, you'll make a black hole that shields this singularity at the center. There are such solutions. So I, if I In the process, suppose I dump enough energy toward the center, I'll make a black hole. This black hole will then decay away through Hawking radiation. Actually, in this case, if the black hole decays by emitting a graviton, this graviton will be bounced back because of this funny asymptotic geometry. If the black hole decays by emitting a D0 brain, which it can, but with exponentially suppressed probability, this D0 brain can escape to infinity. So that should be a contribution to the S matrix of this D0 brain scattering.
If this is something like a negative singularity, how do you know it's not emitting other stuff itself all the time?
Well, in the absence of any perturbation, it's supersymmetric. So I believe that it is stable. In fact, that geometry should be dual to the empty geometry, will be dual to the ground state of the matrix quantum mechanics. And it's a very important and non-trivial result that this matrix quantum mechanics indeed admits a normalizable supersymmetric ground state. That was a very non-trivial result. But it's one of the few things that's actually known about this matrix quantum mechanics. So this slide is basically the things I already said. I think I already said everything here. So this duality with the matrix quantum mechanics in principle allows for the extraction of the flat space-time S matrix of D0 brain scattering type 2A string theory, or slightly harder, but also possible, graviton scattering in M theory at all energies below and above Planck scale. However, to actually do this, one would have to for reasons I didn't fully explain, work in the genuinely non-perturbative regime of the SUN matrix quantum mechanics in the large N limit. The reason the large N will be needed is that in order to have this separation of different length scales, where you have the a large region of weakly curved, say, type 2A supergravity background, that requires N to be very large. Essentially, this radius scales like N to the 1/3, and this scales like N to the 1/7, so it needs to N to be large enough to be able to separate N to the 1/3 from N to the 1/7. Just to give a little indication of why this is such a hard problem, even in the simplest case of this matrix quantum mechanics, where you take N to be equal to 2, SU2 gauge matrix quantum mechanics with 16 supercharges, in the ordinary kind of quantum mechanical description where you want to think about wave function as a function of some coordinates, this wave function will have 2 to the 24 components and have 27 coordinates. And that's only in N equals 2 case, and want to take N to infinity. So it's a rather hard problem. The second example of holography I'd like to discuss is the most famous example to most people, perhaps, the duality between type 2B string theory on ADS5 times S5, the five-dimensional anti-de-Sieur space described by this metric. The time, some xi, I run sum over from 1 to 3, and z coordinate, which describes some radial direction in the De-Sieur space, and a five-dimensional sphere, round sphere. And the dual theory, famously, is, again, 16 supersymmetries, SUN pure Yamil's theory. So in this case, the gravity theory involves type 2B string theory in this particular background, which is anti-de-Sieur space. This background is labeled by two parameters, the string coupling, GS, and a number N, which is flux of N is the field strength of a four-form potential in this 10-dimensional string theory. The way the dictionary goes is that the string coupling, GS, is mapped to the square of the Yamil's coupling of this four-dimensional SUN gauge theory. And N, the number of units of the flux through the phi sphere in the string theory sign, is mapped to the N, the rank of the gauge group. Also note that this maximally supersymmetric Yamil's theory is a conformal field theory. Therefore, the Yamil's coupling is a genuine parameter, it's a marginal coupling. Pictorially, there are various ways to think about the five-dimensional anti-de-Sieur space. One way to think about it is that the z-coordinate essentially characterizes some kind of radial direction so that z equals zero, which was singular in the metric, is really at infinite distance. There's a conformal boundary of the space. That's where this gauge theory lives, and the actual space-time is in the interior. There's another way to view this. I said, one first one to ask, what is the Hilbert space? The Hilbert space of relevance in this context will be the following. So in the gauge theory side, I'll be interested in the space of gauge invariant operators. This is conformal field theory. And the conformal field theory, the interesting, what you would like to think of as analog of a Hilbert space, is the space of local, say, gauge invariant operators. So earlier I showed this picture of a conformal boundary of ADS space at z equals zero and the interior space at non-zero z. There's a conformal mapping, from the perspective of ADS space, it's just an assumption of ADS, but essentially it turns this boundary into a cylinder. So in the sense that this point at the origin will be mapped to, so the cylinder, you can think of this vertical direction as time. This time really comes from the radial direction on the plane here. And this point where the operator is inserted is at time equals minus infinity, and the infinity over here on the plane here is mapped to plus infinity here. This geometry is the so-called global ADS space. It acts much like a box. The cylinder is like a boundary of the space, very loosely speaking. And a particle that moves in the space, that moves toward the boundary, will essentially be bounced back. And in the quantum theory, you expect the typical, all the energy eigenstates should be described by some normalizable wave function in this anti-de-Sitter space. So that would be the Hilbert space. The correspondence says that the space of the set of gauge invariant local operators in SUN, n equals 4 supermules theory, this 16 supercharged gauge theory, are in one-to-one correspondence to the states, by states I mean finite energy, normalizable states, of type 2B string theory in the global five-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space times the five-dimensional sphere. So in anti-de-Sitter space, for the reason I just explained, you expect to have a discrete spectrum that's related to the statement that the spectrum of operators in the gauge theory is also discrete. And you expect each operator to be mapped to a quantum state in anti-de-Sitter space. That will be the Hilbert space. The observables are going to be correlation functions. So in the gauge theory, which is a conformal field theory, you can compute correlation functions of these local gauge invariant operators. Say here you have a three operators insertion, it can be the three-point correlation function. That will be mapped to the boundary correlator of string fields in ADS5, in the sense that on the boundary of ADS space, you introduce some source, which in the pattern of language can be described as some boundary condition for the string field that is due to this operator in the gauge theory. And then you can, if you are powerful enough, you can calculate this boundary correlation function in the bulk string theory. That is the content of this duality.
Question.
Yes.
So you said that different states of the quantum gravity are dual to different operators of the field theory. So what would be the analog of different states of the quantum field theory?
The different states
of the field theory. Yeah.
Good. So you see these different operators. There's something called the state operator correspondence. This is a conformal field theory. The conformal field theory on R4 is equivalent to conformal field theory on S3 cross R under the conformal mapping, which precisely maps a local operator at a chosen point, say the origin of R4, to a state of the theory on the 3-sphere. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between local gauge invariant operators of this theory at a point and gauge invariant, by definition, states on the 3-sphere. So I'm really talking about the Hilbert space of this theory on the 3-sphere. Because this is a component field theory, there are no scattering states in the ordinary sense in flat space, but the appropriate thing to consider is the theory on the three sphere in this case. Why is this duality useful? Well, going from in one direction, from the gravity to the gauge theory side, the strong coupling limit, actually the strong Tuff coupling, the Tuff coupling is defined to be the square of the Yamil's coupling multiplied by the rank of the gauge group, which is n. In the limit of strong Tuff coupling, this n equals 4 super Yamil's theory at large n is mapped to weakly coupled semi-classical supergravity theory in ADS5 times S5, and you can study, you can easily compute quotient functions in this supergravity theories, or you can find various solutions, nonlinear solutions of the supergravity theory, which will describe, which will be used to compute various quantities of this gauge theory at strong Tuff coupling and in large n limit. Well, going from the gauge theory to gravity, it's hard to describe a non-perturbative theory of gravity, and this duality in principle provides an example where you can try to define non-perturbatively a quantum theory of gravity using a gauge theory, which we think is well defined, even at strong coupling. Even if you cannot do calculation analytically, you can try to do Monte Carlo calculation of the path integral. This in principle provides a well-defined non-perturbative framework for quantum gravity, a theory of quantum gravity, which is type 2B string theory in ADS5 times S5, provided that you can compute anything you want in the gauge theory side, which you cannot. So that's going to be where the devil lies. So why is this duality hard? Well, strongly coupled gauge theory is hard. Some things you can compute thanks to a lot of hard work in the last decades, we know how to calculate some quantities in a strongly coupled n equals 4 super Yamil's theory, such as the spectrum of single trace operators at strong Tuff coupling and in infinite n limit. But note that these are mapped to, in fact, the spectrum of free string theory in ADS5 times S5. There are also very nice work on quotient functions of these single trace operators by people here, and also scattering amplitudes on the Coulomb branch of this maximum supersymmetric gauge theory. On the other hand, these results, even though they're nice, do not quite address the quantities that we really want to know in quantum gravity. For instance, we'd like to be able to derive the entropy of the black hole, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole, by counting microstates. We'd like to be able to compute Planckian scattering amplitudes of gravitons in this gravity theory. And these are, in principle, possible to do if you are able to calculate anything you want in the gauge theory. In practice, these quantities are very hard to compute in gauge theory, and there's currently no tractable method to do these calculations. So the regime, while you can say that, of course, we know how to calculate things like S matrix or even the free energy of the gauge theory, which will tell you about the entropy of states in perturbation theory, that would apply in the weak coupling regime. Unfortunately, the weakly coupled gauge theory is still too the bulk gravity theory in a very stringy regime that looks very far from semi-classical gravity. In principle, there exists framework in string theory that allows you to deal with these very stringy backgrounds, but they are hard. I'll just leave it there. And now I'll come to the third example. Which is again of the type ADS-CFT duality between a theory of gravity in anti-de Sitter space and a conformal field theory. The gravity theory in anti-de Sitter space is a higher spin gauge theory, which I'll elaborate later. I realized that I already spent half of my talk, and this is still in the introduction, but anyway, I will say what I can. This hierarchy engaged theory is formulated by Vasiliev. I'll tell you what this theory is. It's a theory of interacting gravitons as well as higher spin massless, in some sense, particles in four-dimensional and the third space. For perhaps your psychological satisfaction, I'll write an equation of motion here, which is very obscure, but I will, if I have more time, I'll try to elaborate a little later. The dual theory is due to this Vasiliev's higher spin gauge theory, is a so-called three-dimensional Chern-Simons vector model, which I'll also elaborate later. At the moment, I'll just write down, say, the action of the Chern-Simons fermion vector model, which involves some, say, UN or SUN or ON or whatever Chern-Simons gauge field A, one form A, interacts through a Chern-Simons action, coupled to a, let's say, in this case, a massless fermion and the fundamental representation of the gauge group. This defines a conformal field theory, as I'll elaborate in a moment, which will be the dual of these Vasiliev theory in ADS4. This is actually much simpler than the previous example I described. So what is the spectrum of states? The gravity theory here, which is the Vasiliev's higher spin gauge theory in four-dimensional anti-Lissure space, the spectrum of particles is the following. Of course, the spectrum of particles isn't the same as the Hilbert space. The Hilbert space consists of single particle as well as multi-particle states. I'm only talking about single particle states here. The single particle states consists of an infinite tower of gauge fields in four-dimensional anti-Lissure space of spin 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way to infinity. So I have this infinite tower of fields of various spins, one each. These are mapped to, I said by ADCFT, these are supposed to be mapped to some operators in the corresponding conformal field theory. And these are indeed mapped to a very simple spectrum of single trace operators in these Chern-Simons vector model, which I'll explain a little later. One nice thing about this duality is that the correction functions are computable in both the gravity side and the field theory side in overlapping regime, therefore allows for a check, if you wish, of the duality in perturbation theory entirely. So sometimes one speaks of ADS-CFT correspondence as a strong weak duality, but that need not be the case. This is an example of ADS-CFT, which can be a weak duality. Namely, the ordinary perturbative expansion in the bulk theory will be just a 1 over n expansion of the boundary theory. Usually, in the previous example, where you have the type 2B string theory in ADS5 times S5, where the bulk theory is, the regime where the bulk theory looks like supergravity, that corresponds to a strongly coupled regime of the boundary n equals 4 super Yang Mills. In this example, the bulk theory in some sense always lies in a very stringy regime. It is described by this higher spin gauge theory. The boundary theory, in fact, has a top coupling lambda, which is actually, I'll discuss that in a moment, it's actually exactly solvable at a finite top coupling and one over n expansion. In that sense, the one over n expansion can be matched on to the ordinary perturbative expansion in bulk theory, and both are in principle computable and can be compared with. So that provides a nice testbed for holography. I'm going to say a few words about higher spin gauge theory. I think I've gone through about a third of the slide, so I have to skip some things. Why are there higher spin gauge theories? It has been a long suspicion it's been long suspected in the study of string theory that because in string theory there's an infinite tower of massive states of arbitrarily high spin, in a very high energy limit of string theory, you might expect that this tower of higher spin string excitations become effectively massless and should be governed by some interacting theory with massless fields of higher spin. They will have to be gauge fields somehow. So we expect some kind of emergent higher speed gauge theory at very high energy limit of string theory. This has never been actually realized for string theory in flat spacetime due to various technical difficulties, but it can be realized in anti-Desire space. I'll skip some discussion of the no-go theorems, which are evaded. Let me just say that we know from the ADS-CFT correspondence that higher spin gauge theory in ADS space, in anti-Desire space, must exist. Because if you take the limit, you can take a limit of the, for instance, the duality between type 2b string theory on ADS 5 times S 5 and n equals 4 super mills, take the limit where the top coupling goes to 0. In that case, the boundary theory becomes free. And in the free theory, there are always conserved higher spin currents. These conserved higher spin currents under ADS safety correspondence are due to bulk fields that are gauge fields. The statement that they're gauge fields is the statement that these currents are conserved, and the spin of the bulk field will be the spin of the boundary current. So if you have higher spin currents in boundary theory, they're due to higher spin gauge fields in the bulk. Yes?
So do you call a spinning black hole a higher spin gauge field?
Spins of black hole? Those are not, when I say higher spin gauge theory, I mean this there are gauge fields that carry spin greater than 2. And these fields are necessarily massless. In ADS space, their mass are not exactly 0, but are of ADS radius scale. So a black hole will have a mass which is much, much bigger. I would not consider that as a, certainly not described by higher spin gauge field. Also here, these higher spin gauge fields are elementary fields
so
of my theory.
So basically, you want the relationship of S spin to mass to be much bigger than
It's more than that. It's there will be no longitudinal degrees of freedom of these higher speed fields.
Yeah.
So they have to be massless in the appropriate sense. If I were to work in flat space, it would have to be massless. In anti-Desire space, they will have some non-zero mass, but this mass is actually fixed in terms of 1 over the radius of ADS space. Okay. So this was actually a story that started long before ADS-CFT. It was realized by Vasiliev in the early 90s that it is possible to construct a fully nonlinear equation motion, classical equation motion, for interacting higher spin gauge fields in ADS-4. This evades all the previous no-go theorems about the impossible kind of triviality of higher spin gauge theory in flat spacetime. Vasiliev systems describe precisely this. I've already actually discussed the field content of that system. The field content is that there is one gauge field of each non-negative integer spin. Of course, the spin 0 case is just the scalar, but there's spin 1, 2, 3, and so on, all the way to infinity. There's a consistent truncation of this theory to include only the even spins, but no further. So you always have to have this infinite tower of spins. Once you have spin greater than 2, you have to have infinite set of spins, roughly speaking. The construction of this theory is a bit technical. I'll try to explain it in a way that's as concise as possible, but yet hopefully still somewhat comprehensible. So there's going to be a four-dimensional spacetime, which will be the end of the Desire space. And there's going to be some internal space, which is purely auxiliary. This internal space is described by, parameterized by a pair of the so-called twister variables. So this twister here simply refers to some commuting spinner variables, which I call, by y and z. In more detail, the y's consist of a chiral spinner, an anti-chiral spinner, and similar for z, but these are just some bosonic internal variables. This y is somehow a generating parameter for fields of different spin. Z is something that is purely auxiliary. And then there's going to be a non-commutative star product one defines on this internal twister space. The field content of Vasiliev theory in the formalism involves a connection one form of the star algebra, sort of the Lie algebra under the star commutator, which I denote by this A, which depends on the space-time coordinates x, as well as the internal twister variables y and z. And then there's the scalar, which is the twisted adjoint, star adjoint representation of that connection one form. And the equation motion can be written in this very concise and deceivingly simple form. It kind of takes a form that somehow reminds one of Chern-Simons equation, but there's some important differences, which I won't have time to explain in detail. Here, this A is the one form. This is the field strength you construct out of the one form. This A is a one form in both the space-time x direction as well as the internal z auxiliary direction. This B, which is a scalar, is a scalar that depends on the the space-time coordinates as well as the internal twister variables. Then there's going to be a function, a star function f star, which just simply means that if I have some function of some one variable with some Taylor expansion, I replace all the products by star product. I did not define the star product for you. It's something that's similar to a Moyal star product. It's non-commutative but associative. K is a particular function of y and z called a Kleinian. I won't explain what it is since I won't really use it for much of this talk. And pi is some twisting that also has to do with the twister variables. I will not explain that either. The equation motion takes this form, and there's a large set of gauge transformations in some standard form. A transforms as a one form connection, and B transforms in a twisted adjoint representation in this sense. So that's a quick summary of Vasiliev's formalism. It's here, the function f of x, I said that f star is a star function. So you take f of x, which is an ordinary function, you replace all the products by star product that you get, then you get a star function. It turns out that by field redefinition, you can put f of x in the following form. F of x is x times e to the I theta x, where theta is a real and even function. This function theta characterizes interactions in the Vasiliev theory. It turns out that if you impose priority symmetry on the theory, then there are only two inequivalent theories, which are called the A-type theory and the B-type theory. The A-type theory has f of x is just equal to x, so you replace this f star, or b star k, by simply b star k, where the B-type theory is just divided by a factor of I, but that changes the relative sign between these two terms, and that has an important consequence on what the theory is. More generally, we'll be interested in the general f of x, which describes a Vasiliev theory that is not parity invariant. This is actually a background independent formulation. However, in order to do perturbation theory, one would have to start with a vacuum solution. This vacuum solution will describe empty ADS4.
Can I listen?
Yes.
I think you said that the bosonic field is in this fundamental representation.
I didn't say that. The bosonic, this scalar here, first of all, everything is bosonic.
Okay.
B is a scalar. It's in a twisted adjoint representation. So if it's an adjoint representation, it will be minus epsilon star B plus B star epsilon. This twisting has to do this pi operation, which I didn't actually define what it is.
Okay.
But it's some kind of involution.
So is it possible to say, in some sense, what the gauge group is and which is being represented?
The gauge group is, I can tell you the gauge Lie algebra. The Lie algebra is just the algebra of star commutators on functions of y and z. That's simply what it is.
Some infinite dimensional.
Yes, it's an infinite dimensional group. It has something to do with a higher spin algebra in three dimensions, which is why this essentially is a higher spin gauge theory. So if you actually ignore the z and only look at the y's, bilinears in y, so remember I have this y and y bar. So I have two y's and two y bars, this a and a dot, you probably cannot see, run from 1 to 2. So you can form 10 bilinears of YY, YY bar, or Y bar, Y bar. Under the star algebra, which I did not actually define what it is, these bilinears of Ys generate the Lie algebra of SO3,2. You take all even functions of Y and Y bar, that generates the enveloping algebra of SO3,2, which is, in fact, is the higher spin algebra in three dimensions. And that's essentially the reason why this is a higher spin gauge theory. But there's quite a number of steps before you get there. So there's some ADS4 vacuum solution. Its precise form does not matter. If you linearize around this ADS4 vacuum solution and look at, in this formulation, there's a ton of auxiliary fields in this A and B, hidden inside A and B. If you linearize the equation around it and solve all the auxiliary fields in terms of the physical propagating fields, what you will discover is a set of, in fact, an infinite power of higher spin gauge fields that are propagating in ADS4. Even though, roughly speaking, this B contains the higher spin analog of the biotensors, whereas A contains the metric-like higher spin field. Normally, when you speak of higher spin field, you think of a, say, spin S, you think of a rank S symmetric traceless tensor field, like this, phi with S mu indices and with some gauge transformation. That is not wrong, but in this formulation, this formalism is a kind of a frame-like formalism. It is possible to go from the frame-like formalism to the metric-like formalism in terms of these higher spin fields, but it's actually extremely complicated to try to write this theory in terms of the symmetric-like fields, which is why Vasiliev's construction was so useful and so clever that if it turns out if you package the symmetric-like fields in terms of frame-like fields, you can write the equation in one or two lines, but if you try to write these equations in terms of the metric-like fields, actually nobody knows how to write them. Because it's explicitly still very complicated.
So question: so there's just one free function in this theory, and that theta function, and that's the only free term.
Correct. This is the level of classical equation of motion. So of course, if you try to quantize the theory, or if you want to compute boundary quotient functions, the overall coupling constant is not here. If you have an action, the h bar sits in front of the action. When you vary the action, and get equation of motion. H bar drops out. So the actual parameter of the theory you'd expect to be the function theta of x together with the overall coupling constant. However, there's a suspicion that, in fact, perhaps the only consistent theory is when theta itself is a constant. Nobody has actually shown that this equation of motion can be derived from an action. However, it is, in a sense that, not only you need to require this equation of motion to come from the variation of the action, this action should have the structure that the linearized equation should be produced from the ordinary two derivative action, quadratic action. This action, it might be that there's some evidence that this action exists, but perhaps only for theta of x equal to a constant. But it has not been shown. I can explain the reason, but perhaps not now. If that's the case, then the theory has two parameters, the overall coupling and the space theta. And actually, that will be a good thing for me, as you'll see in a moment. So this summarizes the structure of the Heisman fields, where they're sitting inside this fields A and B, but it takes some time to absorb this, so let me just skip this slide. Proceeding now beyond the linearized order, we can compute boundary quotient functions. So far the only really non-trivial calculation of boundary quotient functions in this theory was done in my paper with Simone Giambi on the tree level three-point functions of the Vasiliev theory in ADS4 in both the parity the parity preserving case and later in the parity violating case. And also some exact solutions of the theory are known. There's some black hole-like solutions, which are found by Dedenko and Vasiliev. And there are some some solution involving purely scalar excitations in the bulk, which presumably have something to do with mass deformations of the dual CFT that remains to be understood. So I will now elaborate a bit on the duality with the vector model So the this was first the role of Vasiliev theory in the context of ADS-CFT correspondence was first pointed out by Suskin and Sandel and by Klebanov and Polyakov around 2002. Importantly, Klebanov and Polyakov observed that the dual of this theory should be a Lagrangian vector model in the sense that you have some in the sense that the dual CFT should be such that the matter fields are in the fundamental representation of some gauge group. The reason for that is essentially because in the vector model, the single trace operators are simply bilinears constructed out of these fields, which would give rise to a single tower of higher spin fields. In the theory with adjoint matter fields, there'll be much more complicated single trace operators, and we'll have a much more complicated spectrum of bulk fields. That's like what happens with the string field theory in ADS5 times S5. The simplest example of such a vector model is just a theory of n free scalar fields, phi n massless, restricted to ON singlet sector. There's a deformation of this. There's a double trace deformation of this free ON theory by a, you can deform this theory in three dimensions by a dimension two operator, which is the form phi I summed over I squared. Under this deformation, this free ON vector model flows to a critical ON vector model, which is essentially a Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Both, according to the conjecture of Klebanov and Polyakov, which now has been verified in many ways, both of these two theories are due to the A-type priority-preserving Vasiliev theory with two different boundary conditions. So the distinction between the free theory and the critical theory is a, in this case, a double trace deformation. In the large N conformal field theory, deforming the theory by a double trace deformation merely corresponds to changing a boundary condition for the bulk theory in ADS space. So there's some slight generalization of this. Also involve the fermionic version of this, which are, so this roughly speaking, the bosonic ON vector model are due to A-type Vasiliev theory, and the fermionic version of it are due to the B-type Vasiliev theory. Now we can extend this to the general priority violating Vasiliev theory. In the priority violating case, the dual theory was conjectured to be in these papers, some of which I'm involved in. They're due to Chern-Simons vector models. So what are the Chern-Simons vector models? You start with UN or SUN Chern-Simons theory. It's a topological theory that's uninteresting from the point of view of a conformal field theory because there are no non-trivial local Gauge-Meyrin operators. But it becomes very non-trivial if you couple it to massless matter fields. Now it becomes a non-trivial conformal field theory. There's a bosonic version and a fermionic version of it. The Chern-Simons boson theory involved matter fields in the fundamental representation of the gauge group, and Chern-Simons fermion theory involved fermions in the fundamental representation of the gauge group. There's also a supersymmetric version of the theory. Now, the claim is going to be that both the Chern-Simons boson vector model and the Chern-Simons fermion vector model are due to the bosonic Vasiliev theory in ADS4. You may wonder how come the fermionic theory is also due to a bosonic theory in the bulk. The point here is that I'm restricting myself to Gauge-Meyrin operators. And in this fermionic vector model, because the fermions are in the fundamental representation, all the Gauge-Meyrin operators must involve even number of fermions and are bosonic. So dual theory in the bulk is bosonic. So just to summarize this, the conjecture is between bosonic Vasiliev theory in ADS4 with a priority violating interaction phase, which is this theta parameter I discussed earlier. The bulk coupling constant, which does not show up in the equation motion, is supposed to be mapped to 1 over n of the boundary theory, where n is the rank of the SUN Chern-Simons gauge group. The theta is mapped to pi lambda over 2 of the boundary theory, where lambda is n over k, the Tuff coupling of the Chern-Simons matter theory. And you can introduce m flavors of fundamental fermions. These are In this case, the M will correspond to the bulk theory equipped with UM trampolin factor, which simply means that all the higher spin gauge fields are promoted to M by M matrices. So you have a non-abelian higher spin gauge theory in ADS4. And you can do various double trace, triple trace deformation in the transitional theory in ways that preserve conformal invariants. These are due to simply changing boundary conditions of the bulk theory. I'll skip some technical slides. I just want to mention that these theories are exactly solvable in the infinite n limit at any finite top coupling using Schrödinger density equations by working in Lycom gauge of transitional theory. So you can solve for exact self energy of the fermion or the boson matter field in these theories. And then you can solve, in some cases, you can solve the exact four-point vertices. Using these, it is possible to calculate exactly in the large n limit the scaling, some coefficient functions, as well as the free energy of the theory, for instance, as the exact function of the total coupling lambda. The duality can be summarized by this chart. So you have the bosonic Basiev theory in ADS4, with one boundary condition, it's due to Trans-Simons, with one boundary condition, it will be due to Trans-Simons scalar theory. With another boundary condition, it's due to Trans-Simons scalar theory with this critical double trace deformation. On the other hand, there's another conjecture which says the same theory is due to Trans-Simons fermion theory or Trans-Simons critical fermion theory, which is like the Trans-Simons version of the Gross-Naval model, depending on choice of boundary condition. Barring some subtlety, which I won't have time to explain, if these conjectures are true, you will say that, in fact, the Trans-Simons scalar theory and Trans-Simons fermion theory somehow have to be the same, in the sense that, say, the Trans-Simons critical scalar theory must be the same as Trans-Simons fermion theory. If you chase down dictionary, you'll be the statement that they must be the same under exchanging the two coupling lambda with 1 minus lambda and some appropriate rescaling in n. This is a dramatically new claim. It goes under the name of 3D bosonization. So far, it still remains a conjecture, but there's some very non-trivial evidences for this conjecture, which says that, the conjecture really extends to the finite n case. It says that there's some kind of level rank duality between Trans-Simons scalar theory and Trans-Simons fermion vector model. And the previous conjectures of Klebanov and Polyakov, as well as Sussing and Sandel, are the special cases of this duality involving the bosonic Basiliev, parity violating Basiliev theory. Okay, due to lack of time, I'm going to skip the ADS-372 story altogether, which is very interesting by itself, but I'm going to have to skip that. Okay, I'm now going to discuss the connection to string theory very briefly. There's a supersymmetric version of the Basiliev theory. In some sense, there's only one supersymmetric Basiliev theory. Even though here I wrote that formally you can have any kind of n extended supersymmetric Basiliev theory, but they are really all the same up to adding some Champaignan factors. So essentially, there's only one supersymmetric Basiliev theory. There's actually also only one, in some sense, large n Trans-Simons vector model that's supersymmetric. There's essentially only one Trans-Simons vector model in the large n limit. For the following reason. In fact, there are Trans-Simons matter theories of various number of supersymmetries. You can have non-supersymmetries. You can have n equals 1, n equals 2, n equals 3, n equals 4, or n equals 6. In some special cases, you can have write down n equals 8 theory, but with a general n, there are only such theories up to n equals 6. However, in the case when the matter fields are in the fundamental representation, one can as a matter of fact, all these different supersymmetric Trans-Simons vector models differ only by some double trace or triple trace deformation, or possibly gauging a flavor symmetry and couple it to some other Trans-Simons gauge field. All of these operations, namely double trace or triple trace deformation or gauging a flavor symmetry, merely correspond to, on the bulk gravity theory side, a change of boundary condition. So essentially, all of these Trans-Simons vector models are due to the same theory in the bulk, just with different boundary conditions. And in this paper, I wrote with Qiming Zhang, Shirazmin Wala, and Tarun Sharma, we identify precisely the order boundary conditions that will classify these transcendent spectrum models. So in fact, if you didn't know about this transcendent spectrum models with this funny number of supersymmetries, you could have deduced that just by studying the possible supersymmetric boundary conditions in supersymmetric Basilev theory. That analysis is extremely technical. I won't be able to explain the detail here. But the point is going to be the following. There's a particular quiver type transcendent spectrum theory discovered by Aharoni, Bergman, and Jefferies, generalizing the so-called ABJM theory of the following form. This is a three-dimensional conformal field theory. In the Lagrangian description, it has two gauge groups, UN and UM. They're governed by Chern-Simons coupling at level k and minus k, where k is some integer. And then there are matter fields that transform in the bifundamental representation of this UN cross UM gauge group. This theory was known, or conjectured too, but with very strong evidence that is due to type 2A string theory on ADS4 times CP3. With some appropriate amount of flux on this geometry. Now, here we claim that in a different limit, where M is much smaller than N, you regard this as a large N gauge theory with N flavors, and then you gauge the flavor symmetry. In that limit, it is due to N equals 6 supersymmetric, a extended supersymmetric Basilev theory with UM Champagne factor and some particular supersymmetric boundary condition. If both these two duality holds, then these two must also be the same thing, namely this supersymmetric Basilev theory and type 2A string theory on ADS4 times CP3 will have to be the same. How can they be the same? Well, this Basilev theory has some coupling, which is controlled by 1 over n. It has a gauge group in the bulk whose rank is m. So its tooth coupling is, in fact, m over n. This is the bulk tooth coupling, not to be confused with the boundary tooth coupling. This is the tooth coupling of a non-abelian gauge theory, which also has gravity, which also has color gravitons in four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And the strong coupling limit, where m over n is of order 1, when these two gauge groups become comparable, this crosses over to string theory. And you expect the strings to emerge out of the bound states of higher spin particles. From this perspective, in this example, it seems that the higher spin particles are more fundamental than the strings in the sense that the strings are bound states of higher spin particles. Pictorially, I will draw this picture. In the strong bulk tooth coupling limit, the higher spin particles become the leading radial trajectory of the string, which in the semi-classical picture is described by a extended folded spinning string whose tension balances the centrifugal force. Some bound states of these higher spin particles will correspond to some general single string excitations. And in this way, the supersymmetric Basilev theory must be possible to embed the supersymmetric Basilev theory into string theory. The way it happens will be in the sense that the flux tubes of these non-abelian higher spin gauge fields will become the strings. To actually demonstrate directly in the bulk is tremendously complicated because we don't understand too well about the string theory in a very stringy regime, which is necessary to understand this this correspondence. But nonetheless, based on the holographic dualities that's been conjectured so far, this will have to be true. This slide is about ADS-372, which I didn't have time to explain, so I'll skip that. Let me conclude by saying that a word of caution is that these higher spin gauge theories, the interactions are actually non-local in ADS4, and one can ask, are they really close to semi-classical gravity theories, like Einstein gravity? From the perspective of the higher spin vector model duality, ADS-AFT correspondence has essentially two parts. There's a large N limit, which gives rise to weakly coupled gravity in ADS space. That's, I would say, where holography comes from. And then there's a non-trivial statement about the emergence of the bulk locality. The bulk theory becomes local as strong tooth coupling. The higher spin gauge theory is not local, whereas the supergravity theory is local. The higher spin vector model duality has essentially demystified the holographic the holography part, quote unquote, because you can just match correlators, correlation functions, you know, order by order in perturbation theory. There's no mystery there. But the real mystery has to do with why is the bulk theory in the supergravity limit local, come from, say, strongly coupled n equals 4 supergravity Mills theory. In this context of this ABJ triality that I just showed earlier, somehow you have this very non-local interacting Vasiliev theory with some Chern-Payton factor. Somehow in its strong coupling limit, it must somehow magically turn into a local looking string theory that has a supergravity limit. And this is the hard part, which I won't be able to tell you anything about at the moment, but that's something we'd like to understand in the future. I will end by with this picture that captures my feeling of the subject at the moment. Thank you.
Any questions? I've got a few questions. The first one, can you elaborate on your comment about the non-existent production?
Ah.
So you wanted to be quadratic if you expanded it around a particular solution,
Let me explain this. So at linearized level, if you linearize the Vasiliev equation around the vacuum, which is this particular solution, you can show that the equation of motion can all be put in some standard form, which are known as Fraunhofer equation of high speed fields in ADS space. If you add nonlinear correction, it corresponds to replacing the right hand side, which is a zero here, by some quadratic and higher order terms in the fields phi. Yes.
At least the cubic order.
Yes. So if I want, if I have an action, what I want this action to have the property is the following. With a free theory, I know there is a quadratic action, two degrees of quadratic, which is the Fraunhofer action. So when you add these terms, it should come from adding some higher order terms to that action. So I want the action with an expansion in powers of fields whose quadratic part is the Fraunhofer action plus cubic and quadratic and higher. I expect infinite high order in the fields. Such action has not been written down, but it should exist at least when theta of x, for some special theta of x.
To prove that the theory becomes local, you just need to show that this higher spin field becomes massive, except a finite number, or you need more than that.
That would be a first step, but it would not be enough because. It's not enough. So it depends on how strong you want to make the statement of locality. But I would say that if you compute some in the correspondence between n equals 4 supergravity Mills and type 2B string ADS 5 times S 5, you can take some 4-point function of some. Single trace operator in n equals 4 supergravity Mills, take some particular limit and produce flat space scattering amplitude. In fact, it was work done by people that used to be here. S matrix elements of say 2 to 2 graviton scattering in flat space must have some properties. Let's say in the limit of a large partial wave number, they have to fall off very quickly. As required by any S matrix elements of local theory. That is something that's far from obvious from the boundary gauge theory, because generically you expect that, even if things are massive, you might expect that you have some kind of, the interactions are local at order of ADS scale. It's, the thing is that you need to show that there's some, the interaction is local at a scale that's much bigger than the ADS radius scale in the strong coupling limit. And this really should be a consequence of strong coupling dynamics. And you really only expect to see this locality in the strong lambda limit. And that certainly seems to be a hard question. In fact, from the perspective of looking at 2 to 2 S matrix elements, it seems like you have to take a limit of the boundary 4-point function that goes beyond the ordinary top scaling regime.
I have two questions. First, about the non-locality. You said that the Vasiliev theory is non-local. Is that
Let me elaborate a little bit on that. So There's a sign I skipped earlier. At the level of a cubic vertex, actually, there are only finitely many for three fields of given spin, there are only finite number of independent on-shell cubic vertices one can write down. So these only involve up to a finite number of derivatives and are local in that sense. But at quartic and higher order, there are various, nobody has worked out this completely, but there are various indication that you will have interacting terms of arbitrarily high number of derivatives. So in that superficial sense, it could be, it will be non-local. I don't quite have a precise way to categorize how big this non-locality is, but there seems to be no, certainly seems to be no reason to expect it to be a local, to expect the interaction to be local. The point is that the, well, essentially, sort of there's no, unlike the string case theory case where there is a separation between, there can be a separation between a string scale and ADS scale. In this case, there is no independent string scale, string length scale here. So in some sense, the sparsity of theory is an analog of string field theory, but always in the very stringy regime.
I just want to make sure I understand. A star product is non-local, but that was just a star product in the internal space.
Oh yes, that's right. That has nothing to do with that. No, no.
It's because you think that when you have to write down an action, you'll need an infinite number of.
It already shows up at level equation motion. As I said, this equation motion look deceivingly simple. They are very innocent looking, but if you actually try to write down the equation in terms of the independent physical propagating fields, which actually takes a lot of work, you'll find. Interactions of arbitrary high order, and at each order there'll be arbitrary high number of derivatives.
So equation already involves.
Yes. So this equation, even though it looks like a first order equation, that's because there are infinite many auxiliary fields. You can always write any kind of equation motion in terms of first order equation if you introduce enough auxiliary fields. But once you package write this in terms of the physical fields, which are of this shape, and then you'll find couplings of arbitrary high number of derivatives. So there's a lot of horrendous details that I've been hiding from you, in fact.
The second question, so you suggested that the strings would arise as flux to something like the original.
Yes, except that, now, let me just insert one quick comment. So normally we think of that in the context of ADS CFT as, you have some QCD string, but the QCD string living one dimension higher. Here, when I say the flux cube of the Vasiliev, non-being Vasiliev theory, it's the same in the same space time dimension. It's the Vasiliev theory in ADS going to string theory in ADS.
Right, that's like the original QCD strings, right?
Right.
But then the second, what about these other things like D brains and so on? How would they arise in this Vasiliev theory?
I don't know. The reason that's a hard question to answer is I didn't have time to elaborate on the regime. The parameter regime in this ABJ triality. So in fact, where the Vasiliev theory is weakly coupled, the string theory, the ABJ, the type 2A string theory is always in the very stringy regime, in fact. Always in the very stringy regime. I actually didn't even write enough on this slide to show that, but believe me. This is string theory background with this is string theory geometry with the Ramon flux. It's a bit complicated to try to describe this using the usual worksheet formulation, and it's hard to describe D brains in this very stringy regime. Now, the ordinary picture of D brains as some massive charge object wrapping some classical geometry will be valid in the regime where the radius is large in string units. But that's actually mapped to strongly coupled Vasiliev theory. So I don't know how to, it's not obvious to me that I can find this difference in the weak coupled Vasiliev theory. They could look very different from what you naively expect in the semi-classical picture.
Some of those differences can be tapped as defects or modifications
to maybe. Maybe, but I don't have any understanding of that.
So, going back to the question I was asking, so I can think of black holes, but when they're spinning black holes, I'm like very energetic, boosted the spinning black holes. So, if I'm trying to develop an effective field theory for this relativistic spinning black holes,
look like?
Well, of course, the spinning black hole will have a bound so that the angular momentum cannot be bigger than the mass.
But that's for, I mean, that's for a fixed spinning black hole. So I don't, if it's
no, but I'm just saying that you cannot make them make the mass arbitrarily small for given angular momentum, so they cannot be certainly cannot be described by higher spin gauge fields. Now, it's not hard to have you know, we have plenty of examples of massive higher spin fields such as in nuclear physics, but well, we have that all the time. But in that case, the higher spin symmetry doesn't. I mean, there is no higher spin symmetry. It doesn't really help us much. Here, with the higher spin gauge fields, you have an emergent higher spin symmetry, and that actually helps us a lot. In some sense, it's a bit like supersymmetry, where you know certain things, there's certain cancellation, so you can the theory simplifies in the limit where the higher spin symmetry emerges. There's one important point about higher spin symmetry breaking, which I didn't have time to explain. These, in fact, if you have a conformal field theory with exact higher spin symmetries, are always essentially free theories. These transient vector models do not have exact higher spin symmetry. Nonetheless, the transient vector models in the infinite n limit has emergent higher spin symmetry, which are broken by one over n effects. And that's the essential reason why they have a dual as higher spin gauge theory in ADS. So these higher spin gauge theory, they have higher spin gauge symmetry in ADS space, but the gauge symmetry will be, or most of the time, broken by the boundary conditions. So in that sense, the higher spin gauge symmetry are broken, but they're broken in a controlled way.
But again, you're not optimistic about the black hole picture.
No, I mean, I mean, usually, you know, we like to, when we try to formulate, you know, when we try to formulate, you know, or some effective field theory, we like to have the field content to be as simple as possible, and we want to, you know, say black holes should be some, you know, non-perturbative objects in this theory, and of course, in actual, in the real world, or some, you know, actual theory of quantum gravity, you expect that certainly the non-extremal black holes will decay through Hawking radiation. These are not supposed to be part of the scattering states of the theory. So the actual Hilbert space of the theory consists of elementary particles, and all the black holes should eventually decay.
That would be the massless part, right? Because if you have a finite decay time in the rest frame, but they're infinitely boosted, then they could live forever.
Infinitely boosted. Wait, what do you exactly mean by that? I mean, what is?
I guess we can talk about this.
Okay.
Last question. No. If I'm remembering, I think the proofs of the CPT theorem, for example, and also maybe spin statistics, break down when you have infinite component fields. Is there any hints of what's it? Do you know what the status of CPT is in this specific theory? Is it just built in?
Yes, I think so.
Has people considered?
I don't imagine they can be violated because in the context of ADS CFT correspondence. But you have
infinite spins on the other side too.
That is true, but you know, these these fields are supposed to come in pairs of positive and negative helicity, and that statement I think has to be true just from the CFT side.
So on this note, let's end doing it.